Welcome, everybody. This is the second office hours session for the Mises Academy online class, Principles of Economics. This is the spring 2012 edition of this course. And we've got some questions already building up, so let's go ahead and jump right into it. So Laura asks, I cannot seem to get the concept of marginal utility. Can you explain it? Sure. And so again, for people who are just joining us, if you have questions, go ahead and type them in, because Laura's question is a great one, and I can literally take an hour talking about this. So I assume you guys have other questions too, so just go ahead and type them in so I know how long to go. Okay, great question, Laura. So let's trying to think of where to start here. Okay, so first of all, the word utility, that is it's actually like a catch-all term, all right? So it doesn't mean necessarily something that like is physically pleasurable. Okay, so utility is not the same thing as pleasure. It's more just saying like satisfaction, but in a sort of abstract, all-encompassing sense. All right, so I get utility from going to the dentist and getting my cavity treated. All right, what did they pull the tooth? I mean, I think they probably do different stuff nowadays than they did back in 1920. All right, so or cavity filled, whatever they do, pull a bad tooth. So you could even argue that I got more utility from going to work than from staying home, even though, you know, the actual work in the thing, especially if it's working in a factory and it's really hot and everything, you might say that's physically unpleasant, but yet I do it. Or I get utility from going to the gym and working out, even though while I'm there I'm complaining and saying, oh man, I can't stand this, can't wait to be done with this. All right, so I'm just clarifying here that this word utility, all we mean by that is that it's something that gives, that satisfies people, allows them to achieve their objectives. So it's, remember, with a lot of this stuff, it's basically a tautology. I mean, and that's kind of a fancy word. What does that mean, $10 word? That just means you're really just using the definitions of what you started out with, all right? So and remember, this is why when some economists went down this path and said this is what economic principles are, these are what basic economic laws are, it's just us like coming up with concepts and definitions and then just thinking through the implications of those concepts. Not that we're like measuring stuff in the real world, so to speak. Some people said, oh, well then you're not doing anything. You're just playing mind games. It's like you're just sitting in the corner not learning anything about how the world works because you're not going out and observing things and taking measurements. And so the response was, remember, that went over in the first week's lecture, was the analogy of geometry. And I showed you guys that if you think about it, what we do in geometry is we make some definitions. There are some things that just seem obvious to us, and we say, okay, we'll assume that that makes sense, and we'll just put a label on that idea or that notion. Like stuff like, what do we mean by an angle? You know, like if you were talking to somebody and you were trying to show them something in geometry, and they said, whoa, what do you mean by a line? And you're like, well, I mean, you know, like if you had two points and connected them, that would be a line. And they go, whoa, what do you mean connected them? I don't understand. You see what I'm saying? Like if somebody really wanted to be difficult, you couldn't even get going. So what I'm saying, though, is if you're dealing with someone who's halfway reasonable and you just make some sort of patently obvious to you, some self-evident claims, like we can draw two points and we can connect them with a straight line and stuff like that, then you can get off the ground and then you start deriving implications just thinking it through. And the thing is, you know, you would never test that stuff, right? When we come up with when we prove the Pythagorean theorem, we didn't have to go out and measure anything or rely on empirical observations or measurements. It was just thinking through the logical implications of all those different concepts of like points and lines and what do we mean by a right triangle and what do you mean by saying squared, you know, stuff like that. But once we define all those concepts, boom, you can prove to someone that the Pythagorean theorem is true. So that's kind of mind-blowing because it seems like all we did was rearrange the definitions that we just asserted in the beginning. And so you would think that we would end up with no more information than we started out with, right? It seems like we're just saying, let's assume that these things about points and lines and whatever all make sense, and then just rearrange these logical things in our mind without, you know, contradicting ourselves, and then let's see what we end up with. And it seems like going through that process should be a waste of time, and yet it's not. It is very useful for us to walk through geometry and then go build bridges and skyscrapers and stuff that are partly dependent on knowing geometry. So that's the analogy for economics. And so the stuff that we go through here, you can't disprove it. It's not like you would ever see someone do something and then say, oh, I think he's not acting to increase his utility. I think that guy on purpose did something that he knew wouldn't bring him the most utility. That's a nonsense statement. Whatever somebody does purposefully, by definition, is the thing that that person thinks will give him or her the most utility. That's what it means to say it gave the most utility. It's the thing that person would choose. All right. So now this idea of marginal, it's that when you're making a decision, the relevant consideration is, I'm having trouble here defining this properly. You really just want to look at what the decision will actually change, okay? And I think the best way to get that distinction across is to talk about what's called sunk cost. Okay. By the way, just a brief timeout. Some more people have joined us. Please type in your questions into the chat box. I see, Rhett, you put one in the Q&A. That's fine. I'll see that one. But from now on, everybody, just put your questions in the chat box on this, and you don't have to wait for me to finish answering a question. Okay, so right now, Laura had asked a great question about marginal utility, and I'm walking through what that means. Okay, so Laura, let me talk about this thing of sunk cost first, and I think that'll, you know, so I'm not directly answering your question, but I think if I go through this example and you see what I'm talking about here, it'll help deal with this marginal utility. So the principle of marginal utility is when you're making a decision, the thing that people care about is the particular units involved, like it's the change on the margin, and that word margin means on the edge. And so the thing I went over in class was the so-called water diamond paradox, that somebody says, hey, I'm going to give you one present. Do you want a diamond or do you want a liter of water? Just about everybody in normal circumstances is going to pick the diamond. And that seems weird because you'd think diamonds aren't really useful except to look at. They're pretty, and water is essential for life. But you're thinking through, it's because you're not choosing between all the diamonds and all the water. So the point is, whether or not you get that bottle of water, you still have enough to drink. Whereas whether or not you get that diamond the person offered you could make a big difference. Because right now, it's not like you have a diamond to walk around with on your finger or, you know, on a necklace or whatever. But if you got that diamond, that would change your lifestyle. Whereas getting that one bottle of water on the margin doesn't really matter. Okay, so that's what the term means. But now to illustrate it with a different example, I think sunk cost is the best one. So what will happen is a lot of times people, and let me just type in that term just so you know what I'm saying. So it's it's sunk cost, like a sunk ship. So it's sunk cost, that's the term. And it's what happens is a lot of times people reason improperly and they'll say something like this. Like you'll go to a fancy restaurant and you'll be sitting down with somebody and they'll say, you know what, I'm going to be reckless tonight. I'm going to take a big chance and I'm going to order something new off the menu. And they'll say, and the person will go, what is this? And they'll say, oh, it's our soup that we're known for. Okay, I'll get that. And it's a $40 bowl of soup, right, because you're in this really fancy restaurant. And they come and bring it and put it down. The person takes a sip and is like, oh, my gosh, this is just terrible. This is awful. I can't believe I ordered this thing. This is disgusting. And then throughout the meal, they're just forcing themselves to eat it. And you say, well, why do you keep eating it if it's so gross? And you say, oh, because it costs $40. You know what I mean? So I, you know, since I'm paying so much for it, I'm going to sit here and eat this. And so then he said, wait a minute. Suppose we were at some cheap diner, and you had ordered their soup, and it was only $3 for a bowl, and they put that same thing in front of you, and you tasted it, and it tastes like this thing tastes. Would you eat it then? And they say, no, of course not. I would just throw it out. I wouldn't touch it. And so then you say, well, it sounds to me like you're not thinking on the margin. And so just think through it here. At this point, the $40 that you are responsible for the soup is a sunk cost. All right, so assume that you can't just send it back and not get charged for it. Assume that, to make it even cleaner, assume that you took it out, right? You paid for it, then you went back to your apartment, sat down, took the food out, and then the person starts eating the soup and has already paid that $40. So that $40 is gone. So that might help you think through the example better. And the person's forcing himself to eat it because I paid $40 for it. And then he admits if he had only paid $3, he would just dump it in the sink. So for that kind of person, a lot of times economists would say, you're being silly. You're ignoring the principle of marginal utility here. At this point, that, you know, that $40 is irrelevant. That's gone. So your money, the amount of money in your wallet, is going to be unaffected by your decision right now as to whether to continue eating that soup or to dump it in the sink. So it's true, you wish you had never paid $40 for it. And had you known back then what it tastes like now, you wouldn't have done that. But you did do it, so that's just done. That decision is irrevocable. Now the question is, you got that soup in front of you right now, on the margin, how is your utility going to be affected by your decision as to whether to eat that soup or not? And so there the person has to just think, okay, you know, if I start eating it, what's my life going to be like? Or if I dump it down the sink, what's my life going to be like? And so you see that decision, you know, the $40 has nothing to do with that, because under either scenario, the money in your wallet is the same. The $40 is gone. You don't get the $40 back by dumping the soup in the sink. Or sorry, by eating the soup. You don't get the $40 back. So it's not like forcing yourself to eat the soup somehow justifies the $40 you spent. Either way, the $40 is gone. Okay. Another way of thinking about that is when there's things like making production and selling decisions and what to price things for. And so if somebody, let's say, printed up a bunch of T-shirts that said, you know, I went to Mises University 2012 and all I got was this lousy T-shirt or something like that, and it had a picture of Rothbard on it or something, and they thought it would be funny, and it cost them, in terms of expenses, you know, out-of-pocket monetary expense, you know, $5 a shirt, and then they get down there to Mises U and the kids don't think it's funny. They think that it's making fun of Rothbard, so nobody wants to buy it, and so then they realize they have to charge only $2 to sell the shirts. And that some people might say, well, I can't do that because then I'd be losing $3 a shirt. I got to sell them for at least $6. But if they try to charge $6, they barely sell any shirts. But they would bring in more total money if they sold them for $2 versus selling it at $6 a piece. Okay, so there, again, the way to think through that is to think on the margin and to say, on this decision, what are the benefits and what are the costs of charging $6 a shirt or charging $1 a shirt or $2 a shirt, you see. And so that's the thing. You isolate and say, by this particular action that I'm going to take right now, what benefits and what costs do I incur? And then that's the way you should think through the consequences of your actions. So you're thinking on the margin. So the fact that you spend all that money producing those shirts, what would I say, $5 a piece, is irrelevant at that point. Once you get down to Mises U and you've got all the shirts in your van and boxes, that money you spent at that point is gone. And the question is just now, what is the best thing to do with the resources at my disposal going forward? Okay, so I hope that helped a little bit, but that's the idea of marginal utility. Let me give you one last example. This one might even be the simplest one. And then I'll move on to these other questions. When somebody goes into, let me just say one thing. I see Peter, you said you had the question 5 and quiz 1 wrong. It's going to be hard for me to go look it up while I'm dealing with it. So can you, while you're waiting for me to get to your question, can you go look up the exact question and post it? And then that'll jog my memory. Okay, so last thing here, last point on marginal utility to explain that concept. Somebody goes into the store, and she's pushing her cart around, and she sees a deal that says, orange juice, half gallon containers of orange juice are on sale. It's a really good sale. It's $1 for each one, right? So she puts 5 of them in her cart and then keeps walking. So if you didn't have this notion of marginal utility, that would be very hard to explain, believe it or not, something as simple as that. Because if you didn't have marginal utility and you just said to someone, whoa, why did she do that? You say, oh, because she thought that the cartons of orange juice were more valuable in her mind, gave her higher utility or were more subjectively valuable than a $1 bill. And so that's why she wants to trade her $1 bill for a carton of orange juice, right? If we just saw her do a one-shot deal, that somebody came up to her and said, hey, I have this carton of orange juice. I see you have a dollar bill. Do you want to trade? And she said, yeah, sure. And they made that trade and walked away. We would explain that, and we would be correct in saying, oh, the woman who gave the dollar bill for the orange juice, she valued the orange juice more than the dollar bill, and vice versa for the person who gave up the orange juice and got the dollar, right? Those would be all true statements. But now, if we try to explain that with her walking through the grocery store and putting 5 cartons in her cart and then keep going on, that's a little bit weird because you'd say, well, wait a minute. If she thinks the orange juice is more valuable than the dollar bill, why didn't she just keep piling cartons into her cart until either the store ran out of orange juice or she ran out of money? But of course, in the real world, people barely ever do that. They stop at some point. They'll put some units into their cart, but they'll stop well before the store runs out and even before they've used up all the money in their possession. Okay, so to explain that, you have to bring up the notion of marginal utility. So we can't just speak and say, how do you feel about dollar bills versus orange juice cartons? You have to get more specific and say, it depends which unit we're on. So in the beginning, when she doesn't have any orange juice, and let's say she has $10 in her purse, and to make it easy, assume it's like 10 single dollar bills. So she takes one carton and puts it in her cart. Why'd she do that? Because the marginal utility of the first carton of orange juice was worth more to her than the marginal utility of the 10th dollar bill. And so mentally, that's why she's thinking, yeah, I'd buy at least one. She puts the second carton in her cart. Why'd she do that? Because the marginal utility of the second half gallon of orange juice is more to her than the marginal utility of the 9th dollar bill. And so on, through the 5th one, but then she doesn't take a 6th one and put it in because the marginal utility of the 6th half gallon of orange juice is less than the marginal utility of what are we up to? The fifth dollar bill. Right? You see how that works? So the point is that the more units of something you get, other things equal, the marginal utility gets lower and lower. So that's another issue there. And so that's why with the water diamond paradox, that's another way of seeing that. It's because you have so many units of water already at your disposal that the marginal utility of one more unit of water is barely anything. Okay. Peter has a question about one of the quiz questions. Says, what does Murphy mean by the phrase action is a viewpoint? Okay, so I don't, if you want, Peter, if you want to say what you put, I can explain why it's wrong, but while you're doing that, if you want to, I'll explain what I meant by that phrase. So here, what I meant, there was that PowerPoint slide, action is a viewpoint, and then I was talking about it, so this is the sort of thing I was getting at. That, I see the camera kind of moved around on me. There we go. When we talk about purposeful action and say people are using means to achieve ends, what I'm trying to get at there is that is our decision as observers as to how we're going to interpret this situation. Right? Because really, we don't deep down know that other people have minds, right? And this is like an old philosophical problem, right? It's conceivable that you're in the matrix and that all these things around you to which you've normally been attributing intelligence and consciousness and feelings and desires and objectives and stuff like that, it's possible that that's just all an illusion. And on the other hand, it's possible that the things around you in your everyday life that thus far you think are just inanimate, lifeless things, it's possible that they really are conscious, right? Like, maybe the rock in your front yard was a prince that was turned into a rock by some evil witch 200 years ago because he crossed her. So now he's just sitting in your front yard, and every time you walk by him, he's thinking, stop, stop, just say these magic words and turn me back into a prince. But you don't know. You just keep walking. And you're looking at him thinking, oh, that's just a lifeless rock that's obeying the laws of physics. And it doesn't have any desires. But really it doesn't. When it rains, he's like, oh, man, I'm so freezing. I wish it were a sunny day. And the rock's just sitting there having all these desires and stuff like that. All right? So, I mean, I'm exaggerating here and being goofy, but I'm just trying to get you to see, ultimately, we don't really know. We know that we ourselves are conscious and have desires and objectives, and we did things because we had aims that we were trying to achieve. But ultimately, there are some other things in the world that it makes sense, that it's very useful to ascribe similar characteristics to those things, but not to others. And we do this so naturally, automatically, barely even thinking about it, but that's why I'm spending time just pointing out the fact, because you do it so naturally, you probably never sat around and thought about it before. But you get by in the world much better. You navigate through life attributing minds to other objects around you, but not to every object, right? It would be not very useful if you tried to understand your car as being alive, right? Or if every time it rained, you tried to understand that as, oh, the gods are angry, and so what should we do to appease them? And if it weren't raining and you're a farmer and you needed to rain and wondering, why are the gods withholding rain from us? What can we do? Right? That's, I think most of us would think, would not be a very useful way to think about the world. But if you're trying to get a job and you realize, I have to, in order to get this job and to get these green pieces of paper that allow me to go to the store and obtain stuff that I need to survive, what I need to do is go into this office building tomorrow at 9 a.m., sit down and get this blob of cells across the table from me to pick up the phone and vibrate vocal cords and have sound waves vibrate in the air that say, yeah, hire this guy. He did well in this interview. So how do I get that to happen? And the only way you have a shot at getting that to happen is if you think that that blob of cells has a mind, it has objectives, and your goal is to persuade that person. Whereas if your car's not starting, or to get your car to drive to the interview, you don't need to think, what do I need to do to persuade my car to start tomorrow morning? No, you have to just think, how does the car work? Let me make sure I have enough gas in there that I've serviced the engine. You see what I'm saying? That you treat different parts of the world out there differently. And one of the major differences is we attribute minds to other people. And so in particular, what we do is we assume that they act, that they exhibit action, where action is that special, where we had that special meaning for the term that we talked about in the first class of purposeful behavior, where someone has a mind, has goals, and is using means to achieve ends. So, but like I say, that it is a viewpoint. We, as social scientists now looking at the world, just decide in economics we're going to go down that path. We're going to see how much mileage can we get out of this stance of trying to explain things as having minds, whereas that the physicists don't do that. In terms of the raw physics, a physicist looking at the job interview in terms of what can his discipline say about those events would have to say things like, yeah, there was a blob of cells across the table from you, and the reason it didn't just collapse on the floor was that there's like a skeletal structure in there, and we can go and look at the atoms and stuff and see, you know, why those atoms were able to repel each other when they got too close, and why it was able to counteract the force of gravity so that those blob of cells, you know, were stationary in the chair. When the phone went up, we can explain the electrical impulses that went from the nervous system to make the vocal cords vibrate, and then that vibrated the air and made the sound waves. And you see what I'm saying? The physicists, in conjunction with biologists and chemists and neuroscientists and whatever, could give a bunch of perfectly true statements describing that situation, but knowing all that stuff would not at all prepare you for that job interview. To get the job interview to go the way you needed it to go, you would have to know that that person has a mind, and let me try to think through what the person's objectives are. Like, oh, they want to hire someone who's dependable, so I better not be 6 minutes late to the interview. I better not show up wearing my AC/DC t-shirt, you know, that kind of stuff. Whereas if you were looking at it as a physicist or a chemist, there's no way studying the laws of nature you would come up with, oh, I better not be 6 minutes late to the interview. There's no way you would get to that rule of thumb. Okay, so Peter clarified and said, I put B down, which was, if someone is going to use his mind to achieve a goal, he or she has a certain view of how reality works. Right. So, I mean, that's not a terrible answer, but that's really not what the view is. So that is a true statement. If someone is going to use his mind to achieve a goal, he has to have a view of how reality works. And I talked about that in the textbook. So that is a correct statement, but the point is that doesn't really address what I meant when I said action is a viewpoint. So the view, when I say action is a viewpoint, what I mean is the viewpoint of us, the social scientists, looking at the actor. I don't mean the viewpoint of the person doing the action. So it was a little bit subtle, but that's what the distinction was there. Okay, Rhett says, do you know which economic theory Yale subscribes to? Do you mean the University of Yale? Or Yale University? And if that is what you mean, let me just speak a little bit. Okay, that's what you mean. Okay, well, when you get to graduate level economics nowadays, it's very mathematical. All right, so first of all, nobody's an Austrian economist. There maybe are a handful of people teaching at prestigious universities around the world, in economics departments, granting people PhDs. There are a few people who might be sympathetic to a lot of what the Austrian school has to say, but to my knowledge, there is not a single self-described Austrian economist who is on the regular faculty at a PhD granting institution that's, let's say, oh, wait a minute, I take that back. Mario Rizzo is. So Mario Rizzo, I think, has no problem calling himself an Austrian economist, and he is at NYU. But I'm trying to think if there's anybody else like that, and I don't think there are. So don't misunderstand. There are Austrian PhDs, plenty of them, and there are Austrian economists who are on the faculty at schools and even some at schools that give PhDs to people. But I'm saying, except for Mario Rizzo, I can't think of any other ones that are at schools that are ranked, like let's say, in the top 25. So what I'm trying to get around to is that when you get up there in those elite schools where a normal person who wants to get a PhD in economics thinks, oh, I want to get into a good school so I can get a good job and, you know, have a good resume and blah, 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 you're not going to be taught by self-described Austrians. At best, you're going to be taught by somebody who kind of likes the Austrian theory of the business cycle or who thinks that Hayek did a lot of great work on knowledge or something like that. So when you try to say, you know, what theory does Yale subscribe to, it depends how broad or narrow you want to make these distinctions. So if I just say they subscribe to mathematical economics, well, that's certainly true, but that's true just about everywhere nowadays. All right, so if you mean, so more narrowly, we can say there's things like the Chicago School, and then there's, you know, New Keynesianism, and there's neoclassicism, things like that. So it's, without knowing exactly how much of those different classifications you know, it's hard for me to answer. So you say, would they be considered socialists? No, not if you're talking about the economists. If you're talking about, like, people in the English department, yeah, maybe some of them are socialists or in the sociology department. But no, the actual economics faculty at Yale, maybe there's one socialist, but I doubt it. All right, so but believe it or not, I mean, the economists actually aren't as crazy as you might think in terms of that kind of stuff. All right, so I mean, the failure of socialism and to understand why socialism doesn't really work as a system, when I mean like outright central planning where the government owns the means of production, there's very few economists at normal schools, especially top-ranked schools, who think that. Right? There's, I mean, don't get me wrong, there are Marxist economists still, and maybe some of those top-ranked schools might have one on there sort of like as a token, you know, just so they think, oh, we have a heterodox perspective here. But the rank-and-file mainstream are not socialists, at least, like I say, in terms of literally advocating ownership of the means of production by the government. Now, you could argue, you know, somebody like Walter Block might be real purist about it and say, well, gee, if they think that the government should pave roads, then they're socialists in my book, right? So if that's what you mean by saying socialist, well, then, yeah, they're socialist, but so is 90% of the world, at least. But in terms of, are they literally textbook socialists? No. They are probably some version of New Keynesian economists, and then depending on which, you know, within, they probably have a few faculties that are, that, you know, maybe some of them came from Chicago, and so they would probably be more free market oriented, and, you know, would be more skeptical of the government. And my guess is that, I haven't looked at the faculty of Yale closely in a while. My guess is they would be more on the interventionist Keynesian side, but I would be surprised if more than one of them were an explicit socialist. Okay, let's see here. Rhett asks, could you briefly summarize or explain the 2008 crash from an Austrian perspective? Sure. Good question. So I think just about all Austrians would be okay with the following that I'm going to say, is that the dot-com crash occurred, depending on when you time it, 1999, 2000. So the U.S. economy, if Alan Greenspan, who was the Fed chair at the time, had sat back and done nothing, U.S. economy would have gone through a really bad recession. Instead, what did Greenspan do? He brought interest rates way down. From 6.5%, the Fed funds rate went from 6.5% down to 1% by, I think, June of 2003. Okay, so in a 3-year span there, interest rates went way down. And if you look at a chart of the federal funds rate from like 1950 onward, that, and it was held at 1% for a full year from June of 2003 to June of 2004. So that trough there in terms of the federal funds interest rate was the lowest it had been going back, I want to say, to the 60s at least. And then if you adjust for the actual price inflation that occurred, so you get a real interest rate, it was still the lowest it had been since like the 70s. Okay, so it's a very low interest rate. And so the standard Austrian business cycle theory says, well, when the Fed brings rates down low to stimulate a boom and to mask the effects of the crisis, you know, that there was going to be a recession, going to be a big crisis, and instead the central bank comes in and pushes down interest rates and gives this false euphoria, this false sense of economic prosperity. And people were calling Alan Greenspan the maestro and all this stuff. But of course, what happened is it fueled a housing bubble and arguably a bubble in the stock market. So then that eventually had to crash, right? That the economy is driven by real factors, right? So money can screw things up, but ultimately, if you're going to go to the store and be able to get tuna fish and bread and milk, there had to be fishermen out there catching the tuna fish, and there had to be bakers making the bread, and there had to be dairy farmers milking the cows, and all that stuff physically had to come together, and all the production processes had to work. There had to be enough 18-wheelers. There had to be enough refined gasoline to get the 18-wheeler to take the tuna fish from the wharf to the warehouse of the grocery store. You know, the baker had to have enough employees show up to be able to make the bread, da-da-da-da-da. So all these complex things that had to happen and come together just for you to go to the store and get your stuff, those all have physical aspects to them. I mean, it's true, using money helps coordinate all that stuff, but there's ultimately physical stuff going on. So the standard Austrian view is during an unsustainable boom, which is what most Austrians, I think, would say that the period from like 2003 to 2008 was this unsustainable boom. And they would say, well, the economy was cranking out consumer goods, and Americans thought their standard of living was really high, but really they were consuming their capital. that they didn't realize they were setting themselves up for an inevitable crash. That's what it means to say the boom is unsustainable, is that this can't go on. You can keep pumping in more money to keep the illusion up for a while, but that's just going to make the crash that much worse. And so then if you look at a chart of interest rates, of the federal funds rate, so like I said, Greenspan brought it down to 1%, held it there for a year, and then it looks like a staircase if you look at a chart of it. It was like every Fed meeting from June 04 onward, they started hiking it by like 50 basis points because they wanted to, they didn't want to slam the brakes, but they realized that price inflation was starting to rise and that, you know, in terms of the way the Fed describes stuff, they would say, oh, we have to remove accommodation, that inflationary pressures are building, and so we have to start tightening. That's the way they would talk about it. And so they started doing that, and then, you know, entrepreneurs realized that their projects were unsustainable. The housing market, once housing prices topped and started to decline, all the people who had been just speculators, you know, people who were going to flip houses to buy a house at $300,000, put in some renovations, and then sell it a year later for $400,000. Once prices turned, all those people tried to sell because, like, they had borrowed money to get in thinking they were going to make a quick profit. And then when they saw they weren't going to make a profit, they were just trying to sell and get out before it was too bad. So now once prices topped, everyone's trying to, or a lot of people are trying to sell, that makes prices fall even further, and that just causes the snowball effect. All right, so that's, I think, the standard Austrian view about the boom and then why a crash was necessary. And then in terms of what did the Fed and the government do in response to the 08 crisis, I think most Austrians would say they did the exact wrong thing. That, you know, having a huge stimulus package and the big TARP program, just crazy. It just wastes more resources when the economy needs resources the most. You know, when the private sector is on the ropes, that's the last time in the world that you want the government to come in and run multi-trillion-dollar deficits to spend money on so-called public works. And when the economy is all screwed up and the financial sector is screwed up from really bad decisions, that's the worst time to have the Treasury come in and take over a bunch of the big banks and to prop them up. That's the worst thing to do at that sort of juncture, and yet that's what happened. So it's not surprising that we just seem to be in this funk and the economy's just limping along. Here we are 4 years later and the economy's still awful. And, you know, the Austrians would say, well, what do you think's going to happen? You know, you did the exact wrong things. If you had just stayed back and done nothing, there would have been an awful crash in late 2008, a bunch of banks would have gone down. It might have been really bad. Unemployment might have been 15%, but it would have been like that for 3 or 4 months. And then we would have hit rock bottom and then started to recover. And now all those idiots who made those bad lending decisions during the boom would be out of business. And from this point going forward, financial market decisions would have been conducted by the people who were relatively prudent, because they would have been the ones, they wouldn't have been the ones to go down. Because there were lending institutions that stayed away from the mortgage-backed securities and all that kind of stuff during the boom. Or they just didn't get into it as heavily because they said, wait a minute, this is risky. So if those major banks had gone down, yeah, that would have been painful, but what it means is then the credit markets afterward would have been dominated by the firms that made smart lending decisions and didn't just give mortgages to people who filled out a form and didn't bother checking to see if they actually had a job. But the way it is now, that didn't happen. The prudent firms did not capture market share because the big ones got bailed out. And so the lesson that was taught is the next time there's a bubble like that, get in, earn millions of dollars in bonuses, and then, you know, if a crash comes, well, the government's going to come in and bail everyone out anyway, so nothing you can really do about that. Okay, we got about 10 minutes left. Sam Dugan says, what would you say are the top three best colleges for learning Austrian economics? I am considering both Auburn and Hillsdale. Okay. Oh, and then also let me pull up in that Q&A thing from Rhett to make sure I don't miss that one. Okay. First of all, what you should do is email Walter Block. Because he literally has like a, he has compiled a list of Austrian-friendly undergraduate institutions. I mean, it's like he's got at least 30 places on there. So and he's got to describe, like, there's differences. Like, there are schools, like, for example, Hillsdale College and Grove City College, they both have explicit Austrian courses, right? So you, so at Hillsdale, when I was a professor there, I haven't looked at their syllabus in the last year or two, but back as of, when did I leave there? As of 2006, they still had an Austrian 1 and Austrian 2 sequence, right? So you could take two whole classes as a major in Austrian economics. So in the Austrian 1, when I taught it there, you know, I would walk people through the basics. Like, we used Gene Callahan's book, and, you know, we'd read sort of easy Austrian stuff just to give a you know, main message. And then in Austrian 2, I think I went through Roger Garrison's book. So I really taught, you know, some hardcore stuff. And then, you know, I did other stuff too. I didn't just use Garrison's book. But the point is, we really got into serious hardcore Austrian economics stuff in that second course. So, but that's fairly rare. And the same thing in Grove City. I'm pretty sure if you go to Grove City and you're an economics major, it's not merely that you take macro from a person who's going to use Austrian business cycle theory. It's like you literally can take a class called Austrian economics, I believe. All right, so there's that level of in-depth Austrian stuff. And then there's lower tiers where you could go to a school where the faculty is very Austrian friendly, but there's actually not a course in the syllabus called Austrian economics. It's just that, oh, when you take micro, the person's going to use Rothbard or whatever. Okay, so there's that. And then the next level would just be, oh, there's a school somewhere, the department is kind of free market, and there's one person on the faculty who is an explicit Austrian. You know, so like that teaches, the lectures at Mises University every summer, but that guy is the only person in his department who calls himself an Austrian. So if you go to that school, you know, you can hang out in that guy's office all the time talking about Mises and Hayek and Rothbard, but the rest of your classes are going to be standard public choice, you know, Chicago school kind of stuff. Right? So there's those different aspects. The thing is, like you said, Auburn. So just so you're aware, the faculty at Auburn University, it's not like they're all a bunch of card-carrying Austrian economists. There's only one or two that, for which that's true, you know, that would say, oh, yeah, I'm an Austrian. The reason you would go to Auburn is because the Mises Institute's right there. So that's why if you want to learn Austrian economics, going to Auburn would be awesome. It's because you would just be within walking distance of the Mises Institute. You could just hang out there, you know, and go to their events and stuff like that. So more generally, nowadays, it's not nearly as important as it used to be. You know, with the rise of the internet, it's not as important now that you physically attend a school that has Austrian economists on the faculty. But I think it's much more practical nowadays for students who want to learn Austrian stuff. And even to, you know, to get a PhD in economics and be teaching somewhere and teaching from human action, you don't need to go to an undergraduate school that has an Austrian on the faculty. In fact, I'd almost say if that happened, it would just be by coincidence that what you might consider doing is just going to the best school you can where the faculty is at least free market and that you're not going to, you know, just be miserable and be psychologically in a depression the whole time. But then you learn Austrian stuff, you know, from taking online classes from me and other people, going to the Mises Institute events, you know, going to events that FEE puts, the Foundation for Economic Education, stuff like that. That there's plenty of ways you can learn Austrian stuff on your own and you will be totally up to speed. It's not like you're going to be at a disadvantage. And then on your resume, you know, you've gone to a really top-ranked economics or, you know, college, and if you have a good GPA and you do well in the GREs, then you get into a really good grad school and so forth. So my point is, if you want to have a career as an Austrian economist, I don't think you should start by saying, okay, the first filter I'm going to apply is I have to go to a school where there's Austrians there. So that's just what I'm warning. But anyway, go email Walter Block and ask him for that list. Okay, Rhett asks, we got about 5 minutes left, everybody. Rhett asks, I hope this is not too off topic, but with your knowledge of economics, would you advise people to invest in real estate? Why or why not? Thank you. I don't, it's not an issue of it being too off topic, like these office hour sessions, it's a free-for-all, but I'm not going to say something definitive on that because I get lots of people emailing me stuff like that, and I just don't, because I'm going to get sued. You know, if I just start firing off and telling people, oh, yeah, invest in real estate or buy gold or short treasuries, whatever I say, somebody eventually is going to take my advice, or even if they do the opposite and they thought they were taking my advice, and then they're going to lose money and sue me. So that's why it's a general rule. I know if you could say, well, no, I wouldn't do that, Dr. Murphy. I know you wouldn't. But the point is I literally get hundreds of those kind of questions a year, and I just had to have a policy of I can't be firing off financial recommendations to people because that's only going to come back and bite me. So I'm not going to answer your question, but it's not because it was off topic. It's because it's something about financial advice. Let's see. George Smith says, let me just say, Sam, sorry, to just wrap up my answer to you about colleges. Both Hillsdale and Grove City, I know the faculty there, and if you went there, that would be awesome to either of those places. Hillsdale, just be careful. I don't know what your overall political philosophy is, but I know a lot of people who are into Austrian economics and who like the Mises Institute tend to be very libertarian also, right? Keep in mind, everybody, Austrian economics is not the same thing as libertarianism. The two in practice often go hand in hand in the embodiments of the people who subscribe to them, but in principle, you could be an Austrian economist and be a Democrat with a capital D. That would be very odd, but in theory it's possible. And what Walter Block likes to do to motivate that is to say, what if you just hate people, right? You could be an Austrian economist, and then you could vote for politicians who are going to impose rent control and raise taxes and put in tariffs because you like human suffering. And so your knowledge of Austrian economics tells you the way to maximize human suffering and to inflict poverty on people is to have all these government interventions. So I'm going to go and vote for, you know, interventionist big government candidates, even though I'm an Austrian economist. So I'm clearly not a libertarian in my political views, right? So I'm just, again, that would be very rare to have someone like that, but just trying to make the point. So what I'm saying, Sam, is the one thing about Hillsdale to be careful about is if you happen to, you know, be a fan of LouRockwell.com or something, Hillsdale, the economics department is top notch. You'd get along fine there, but the history department and the political science department, some of the people there are extremely hawkish on foreign policy, and so is the administration. Like, they were big supporters of the invasion of Iraq. They think America's role in the world is to defeat terror, you know, Islamofascism and so forth. So I'm just warning you, because I know a lot of people who like Austrian economics would favor, you know, are fans of Ron Paul, to put it succinctly. Ron Paul would probably not get invited to give a big speech at Hillsdale College just because a lot of the administration do not like what he stands for. So some of the people do, don't get me wrong, but I'm just saying the climate there, it's bifurcated, and so if that's something you care a lot about, you should just have that in mind. Okay, George. Okay, we've got just a couple more minutes here. George Smith says, will you be teaching another course on the Fed this year? Probably, but I'm not sure. It partly depends on what the other stuff with my consulting business. It depends how that stuff turns out. I'm trying to get things in motion that will bring in revenue that, like, you know, 6 months from now, so that I'm not having to work 40 hours a week just paying my bills. And so if those projects turn out the way I hope they will, that will free up my time and I can be more of an academic again, in which case I would love to, like, do a course on free banking and stuff like that. But I can't do that kind of stuff right now because I don't have the time to go read it. And it wouldn't be right for me to do a course on free banking unless I went and read all the stuff by Selgin and Horowitz and so forth. And I don't have time to do that right now. So quick answer, George, is I don't know. Okay, and then last question, Rhett says, referring to the 2008 crash, what's the Austrian answer, and is it still possible to apply it with success given where we are? Again, whenever somebody says, what would the Austrians think about something, you have to be careful. There are different views. So in particular with this one, the Austrians right now are not all of a uniform opinion on what the proper Fed policy should be. So I just want to put that out there. So what I will say is what I think most Rothbardians would say is the Fed should, first of all, stop inflating more, and then it's a question of do they just stop doing anything and let their assets dwindle, or do they just sell off everything and close its doors tomorrow? I mean, that's more of a strategic question, but clearly the Fed should stop actively buying assets and inflating the money supply. It should just, cease doing that, and then as the Fed's assets matured, it would, like, effectively be sucking the credit out of the markets that it had pumped in the last few years, and then interest rates would start rising. The government should massively cut its spending and then cut taxes also, so to effectively return those resources back to the private sector. Another dispute within the Austrian camp is, what does the federal government do with the huge debt that it has right now? So some people would say, oh yeah, the government should really cut its spending down, cut taxes, and then at least balance the budget or run a surplus and then start paying off the debt as quickly as possible. Whereas other Austrians, and this would include Murray Rothbard, I think, would say, just repudiate the debt. That's the way you deal with the debt crisis. Just say, we're not paying this stuff back ever, and just stop making interest payments on it. And that would clear up a lot of room in the budget right there, that you could, cut taxes. And then what would happen, people would be scared to lend to the federal government again. And Rothbard would say, good. We don't want people lending to the federal government. That just gives them money to go do horrible things. So, and just in the morality of it, to service the government debt, to pay off the debt, means the U.S. government taxes some people, takes their money by force to then pay off bonds to other people, when the people who are being taxed right now may have had nothing to do with this decision made 20 years ago to incur federal debt paying for programs back then. Some of the people right now who are being taxed to service government debt weren't even alive when some of those decisions were made and that debt was incurred. All right, so in terms of just the morality of it, Rothbard would say, just stop servicing, just repudiate the debt altogether. And so that kind of stuff, Austrians, I think, would say, whether we were in good times or bad times, that's always true. And yeah, it is true right now. That's the last thing I'll say, and then I'm going to sign off. What is true is that if you were to implement those things right now, it would be really bad. In other words, if you did that when the economy was fairly decent, it might cause a little bit of restructuring of all those laid off government employees having to get new jobs and stuff. But if right now when unemployment is still pretty high, if all of a sudden you started laying off millions of government workers, then, you know, it might seem particularly harmful, or not harmful, like tough medicine to do it right now. So I think most Austrians would still say, but it is the right thing to do, that when the patient is sick is when you need the medicine the most. And that actually, again, it's not, the Fed is not really helping us by pumping in more money quarter after quarter. So it's not right to say, oh, well, yeah, let's gradually ease off because the economy is so vulnerable right now. That I think most Austrians would say, no, precisely because we're so vulnerable right now, that's why we can't screw around. We have to stop doing these harmful things. But the point is, by removing this false sense of prosperity that the Fed has given us right now, when the true situation is as bad as it is, people would be shocked and they'd say, oh my gosh, this is awful. And the Austrian point would be, yeah, it was this awful 2 months ago too, it's just you didn't know it because the Fed was screwing with all the prices. But now we're seeing what the reality was. So that's kind of the I think the way a lot of Austrians would handle it. So to answer your question, yeah, it would work and we should do it, but it would be really painful. You know, there would be a tremendous crash. Unemployment might go up to 15%, but that would, you know, once we got through that, then you'd have a solid recovery. Whereas what we're doing now, there's still going to be an awful crash. That's the thing. It's not that if we keep going doing what we're doing, we're going to avoid an awful crash. But the point is, we can postpone it and make it worse. So the issue is, do we have, you know, an earthquake of 8 right now, or do we have an earthquake of 9.9 2 years from now? But don't think you're going to get around having an earthquake. That's kind of the issue. Okay, well, thanks for tuning in, everybody. We hope that was helpful. And I will see you Wednesday.